hoping just the opposite. And then I recall something else. The woman who wanted to tell me about my mother. She's been there the whole time. And if she's willing to sell one kind of information for her freedom, maybe she's willing to sell another. As I think over what I'd like to know, it occurs to me how much more useful it would be to send information to Bilkin instead of getting information out of him. If I let that prisoner believe I was temporarily freeing her to tell me about my mother, then I could drop some information in her ear. Something about Oak. Something about his whereabouts or vulnerability. She wouldn't be lying when she passed it on. She would believe she'd heard true and spoke truth. I puzzle further and realize, no, it's too soon for that. What I need now is to give the prisoner simpler information that she can pass on, information I can control and verify, so that I can be sure she's a good source. Bilkin wanted to send Cardin a message. I will find a way to let him. The Court of Shadows has begun to formalize the scribing of documents on the denizens of Elfheim, but none of the current scrolls deal with any prisoners in the tower but Bilkin. Walking down the hall, I go to the bomb's newly dug office. She's there, throwing daggers at a painting of a sunset. You didn't like it? I ask, pointing to the canvas.
I liked it well enough, she says. Now I like it better.
I need a prisoner from the Tower of Forgetting. Do we have enough uniforms to dress up some of our new recruits? The knights there have seen my face. Vulsaber can help smooth things over. But I'd rather not risk it. Better to forge some papers and have her out with fewer questions. She frowns in concentration.
Whom do you want?
There's a woman. I take a piece of paper and grit out the bottom floor as well as I can. She was up the staircase, here, all on her own. The bomb frowns.
Can you describe her?
I shrug. Thin face, horns. Pretty, I guess. You're all pretty.
What kind of horns?
The bomb asks, tilting her head to one side, as though she's considering something.
Straight? Curved?
I gesture to the top of my head where I remember hers being. Little ones. Goatish, I guess. And she had a tail.
There aren't that many folk in the tower,
the bomb explains.
The woman you're describing.
Do you know her? I ask.
I've never spoken a word to her, the bomb says. But I know who she is. Or who she was. One of Eldred's lovers, who begot him a son. That's Cardin's mother.
Chapter 14. I drum my fingernails against Dane's old desk as the roach leads the prisoner in.
Her name is Asha, he says. Lady Asha.
Asha is thin, and so pale that she seems a little gray. She does not look much like the laughing woman I saw in the crystal globe. She is looking around the room in an ecstasy of confusion. It's clear that she's pleased to be away from the Tower of Forgetting. Her eyes are hungry, drinking in every detail of even this rather dull room. What was her crime? I ask, downplaying my knowledge. I hope she will set the game and show more of herself that way. The roach grunts, playing along.
She was Eldred's consort, and when he tired of her, she got tossed into the tower.
There was doubtlessly more to it than that, but all I have discovered is that it concerned the death of another lover of the High King's and, somehow, Cardin's involvement. Hard luck, I say, indicating the chair in front of my desk, the one to which, 5 long months ago, Cardin had been tied. Come sit. I can see his face and hers. They share those ridiculous cheekbones, that soft mouth. She sits, gaze turning sharply to me.
I have a powerful thirst, Do you now?
The roach asks, licking a corner of his lip with his black tongue.
Perhaps a cup of wine would restore you.
I am chilled, too, she tells him. Cold, down to the bone. Cold as the sea. The roach shares a look with me.
You tarry here with our own Shadow Queen, and I will see to the rest.
I do not know what I did to deserve such an extravagant title, and fear it has been bestowed upon me as one might bestow an enormous troll with the moniker Tiny, but it does seem to impress her. The roach steps out, leaving us alone. My gaze follows him for a moment, thinking of the bomb and her secret. Then I turn to Lady Asha. You said you knew my mother, I remind her, hoping to draw her out with that, until I can figure out how to move on to what I really must know. Her expression is of slight surprise, as though she is so distracted by her surroundings that she forgot her reason for being here. You resemble her very strongly. Her secrets, I prompt. You said you knew secrets about her? Finally, she smiles. Ava found it tedious to have to do without everything from her old life. Oh, it was fun for her at first to be in Fairyland. It always is. But eventually they get homesick. We used to sneak across the sea to be among mortals, and to take back little things she missed. Bars of waxy chocolate. Perfume. Pantyhose. That was before Justin, of course. Justin and Ava. Ava and Justin. My mother and my father. My stomach lurches at the thought of there being two people Asha knew better than I ever did. Of course, I echo anyway. She leans forward across the desk. You look like her. You look like them both. And you look like him, I think. You've heard the story, I'll wager, Asha says. How one or both of them killed a woman and burned the body to hide your mother's disappearance from Matic. I could tell you about that. I could tell you how it happened. I brought you here so you could do just that, I tell her. So you could tell me everything you know. Then have me thrown back in the tower? No. My information is worth a price. Before I can answer, the door opens, and the roach comes in carrying a tray piled with cheese and brown bread and a steaming cup of spiced wine. He wears a cape over his shoulders, and after setting down the food, he sweeps it onto her like a blanket.
Any other requests?
He asks. She was just getting to that, I tell him. Freedom, she says. I wish to be away from the Tower of Forgetting. And I wish safe passage away from Innsmore, Innsweel, and Innsmire. Moreover, I want your promise that the High King of Elfheim will never become aware of my release. Eldred is dead, I tell her. You have nothing to worry about. I know who the High King is, she corrects sharply. And I don't want to be discovered by him once I am free. The roach's eyebrows rise. In the silence, she takes a big swallow of wine. She bites off a hunk of cheese. It occurs to me that Cardan very likely knows where his mother was sent. If he has done nothing to get her out, nothing to so much as see her since becoming High King, that's intentional. I think of the boy in the crystal orb, and the worshipful way he stared after her, and I wondered what changed. I barely remember my mother, but I would do a lot to see her again, even just for a moment. Tell me something of value, I say, and I will consider it. So I am to have nothing today? She wants to know. Have we not fed you and clothed you in our own garments? Moreover, you may take a turn around the gardens before you return to the tower. Drink in the scents of the flowers, and feel the grass beneath your feet, I tell her. Let me make myself clear. I do not beg for comforting reminiscences or love stories. If you have something better to give me,
Then perhaps I will find something for you. But do not think I need you. She pouts.
Very well.
There was a hag who came across Maddox land when your mother was pregnant with Vivienne. The hag was given to prophecy and divined futures in eggshells. And do you know what the hag said? That Ava's child was destined to be a greater weapon than Justin could ever forge. Vivi, I demand. Her child, says Asha, although she must have thought of the one in her belly right then. Perhaps that's why she left, to protect the child from fate. But no one can escape fate. I am silent, my mouth a grim line. Cardin's mother takes another drink of wine. I will not let any of what I feel show on my face. Still not enough, I say, keeping myself focused on the hope this information will find itself to Baelkin, on the hope that I have found a path to outwitting him. If you think of something better, you can send me a message. Our spies monitor notes going in and out of the Tower of Forgetting, usually at the point they're passed to the palace. Whatever you send, no matter to whom it is addressed, if it leaves the hand of the guard, we will see it. It will be easy to let me know if your memory comes up with anything of more value. With that, I get up and step out of the room. The roach follows me into the hall and puts a hand on my arm. For a long moment, I stand there wordlessly, trying to marshal my thoughts. He shakes his head.
I asked her some questions on the way here. It sounds as though she was entranced by palace life, besotted with the High King's regard, glorying in the dancing and the singing and the wine. Cardin was left to be suckled by a little black cat whose kittens came stillborn.
He survived on cat milk? I exclaim. The roach gives me a look, as though I've missed the point of his story entirely.
After she was sent to the tower, Cardin was sent to Baelkin, he says.
I think again of the globe I held in Eldred's study, of Cardin dressed in rags, looking to the woman in my chamber for approval, which came only when he was awful, an abandoned prince, weaned on cat milk and cruelty, left to roam the palace like a little ghost. I think of myself, huddling in a tower of Hollow Hall, watching Baelkin enchant a mortal into beating his younger brother for poor swordsmanship. Take her back to the tower, I tell the roach. He raises his eyebrows.
You don't want to hear more about your parents?
She gets too much satisfaction in the telling. I'll have the information from her without so many bargains. Besides, I have planted a more important seed. Now I have only to see if it grows. He gives me a half smile.
You like it, don't you? Playing games with us. Pulling our strings and seeing how we dance.
The folk, you mean?
I imagined you'd like it as well with mortals. But we're what you're practiced in.
He doesn't sound disapproving, but it still feels like being skewered on a pin.
And perhaps some of us offer a particular savor.
He looks down his curved goblin nose at me until I answer. Is that meant to be a compliment? At that, his smile blooms.
It's no insult.
Chapter 15. Gowns arrive the next day, boxes of them, along with coats and cunning little jackets, velvet pants, and tall boots. They all look as though they belong to someone ferocious, someone both better and worse than me. I dress myself, and before I am done, Tatterfell comes in. She insists on sweeping back my hair and catching it up in a new comb, one carved in the shape of a toad, with a single simophane gem for an eye. I look at myself in a coat of black velvet, tipped with silver, and think of the care with which Taryn chose the piece. I want to think about that, and nothing else. Once, She said that she hated me a little for being witness to her humiliation with the gentry. I wonder if that's why I have such a hard time forgetting about what happened with Locke. Because she saw it. And whenever I see her, I remember all over again how it felt to be made a fool. When I look at my new clothes, though, I think of all the good things that come from someone knowing you well enough to understand your hopes and fears. I may not have told Taryn all the awful things I've done and the terrible skills I've acquired, but she's dressed me as though I had. In my new clothes, I make my way to a hastily called council meeting and listen as they debate back and forth whether Nikasia took Cardin's angry message back to Orla and whether fish can fly. That's Fala.
Whether or not she did doesn't matter,
says Matic.
The High King has made his position clear. If he won't marry, then we have to assume that Orla is going to fulfill her threats. Which means she's going to go after his blood.
You are moving very fast, says Randolin. Ought we not yet consider that the treaty might still hold?
What good does it do to consider that?
Says Mikkel, with a sidelong glance at Nior.
The Unseelie courts do not survive on wishes.
The Seelie representative purses her small insect-like mouth.
The stars say that this is a time of great upheaval,
says Bafin.
I see a new monarch coming, but whether that's a sign of Cardin deposed, or Orla overturned, or Nikasia made queen, I cannot say.
I have a plan,
says Matic.
Oak will be here in Elfheim very soon, when Orla sends her people after him. I mean to catch her out.
No, I say, surprising everyone into looking my way. You're not going to use Oak as bait. Matic doesn't seem particularly offended by my outburst.
It may seem that's what I am doing.
Because you are, I glare at him, remembering all the reasons I didn't want Oak to be High King in the first place, with Matic as his regent.
If Orla plans to hunt Oak, then it's better we know when she will strike, than wait for her to move. And the best way to know is to engineer an opportunity.
How about removing opportunity instead, I say. Matic shakes his head.
That's nothing but the wishes Mikkel cautioned against. I've already written to Vivienne. They plan to arrive within the week.
Oak can't come here, I say. It was bad enough before, but not now.
You think the mortal world is safe?
Matic scoffs.
You think the Undersea cannot reach him there? Oak is my son. I am the Grand General of Elfheim, and I know my business. Make any arrangements you like for protecting him. But leave the rest to me. This is no time for an attack of nerves.
I grind my teeth. Nerves? He gives me a steady look.
It's easy to put your own life on the line, isn't it? To make peace with danger. But a strategist must sometimes risk others, even those we love.
He gives me a significant look, perhaps to remind me that I once poisoned him.
For the good of Elfheim.
But I bite my tongue again. This is not a conversation that I am likely to get anywhere with in front of the entire council, especially since I am not sure I'm right. I need to find out more of the Undersea's plans, and I need to do so quickly. If there's any alternative to risking Oak, I mean to find it. Randolin has more questions about the High King's personal guard. Matic wants the lower courts to send more than their usual allotment of troops. Both Nior and Mikkel have objections. I let the words wash over me, trying to corral my thoughts. As the meeting breaks up, a page comes to me with two messages. One is from Vivi, delivered to the palace,
asking me to come and bring her and Oak and Heather to Elfheim for Taryn's wedding in a day's time, sooner even than Maddox suggested. The second is from Carden, summoning me to the throne room. Cursing under my breath, I start to leave. Randolin catches my sleeve.
Jude, he says, allow me to give you a word of advice.
I wonder if I'm about to be scolded.
The Seneschal isn't just the voice of the king, he says. You're his hands as well. If you don't like working with General Matic, find a new Grand General, one who hasn't previously committed treason.
I knew that Randolin was often at odds with Matic in council meetings, but I had no idea he wanted to eliminate him. And yet, I don't trust Randolin any more than I do Matic. An interesting thought, I say, in what I hope is a neutral manner, before making my escape. Carden is lounging sideways on the throne when I come in, one long leg hanging over an armrest. Sleepy revelers party yet in the great hall, around tables still piled high with delights. The smell of freshly turned earth and freshly spilled wine hangs in the air. As I make my way to the dais, I see Taryn, asleep on a rug. A pixie boy I do not know slumbers beside her, his tall dragonfly wings twitching occasionally, as though in dreams of flight. Locke is wide awake, sitting on the edge of the dais, yelling at musicians. Frustrated, Carden shifts, legs falling to the floor.
What exactly is the problem here?
A boy with the lower half of a deer steps forward. I recognize him from the Hunter's Moon Revel, where he played. His voice shakes when he speaks.
Your pardon, Your Majesty. It's only that my lyre was stolen.
So what are we debating?
Carden says.
A lyre is either here or gone. Is it not? If it's gone, let a fiddler play.
He stole it.
The boy points to one of the other musicians, this one with hair like grass. Carden turns toward the thief with an impatient frown.
My lyre was strung with the hair of beautiful mortals who died tragically young,
sputters the grass-haired fairy.
It took me decades to assemble, and was not easy to maintain. The mortal voices sang mournfully when I played. It could have made even yourself cry, begging your pardon.
Carden makes an impatient gesture.
If you are done with bragging, what is the meat of this matter? I have not asked you about your instrument, but his.
The grass-haired fairy seems to blush, his skin turning a darker green, which I suppose is not actually the color of his flesh, but of his blood.
He borrowed it of an Eve, he says,
pointing toward the deer boy.
After that, he became obsessed, and would not rest until he'd destroyed it. I only took his lyre in recompense, for though it is inferior, I must play something.
You ought to punish them both, says Locke, for bringing such a trivial concern before the High King.
Well?
Carden turns back to the boy who first claimed his lyre was stolen.
Shall I render my judgment?
Not yet, I beg of you,
says the dear boy, his ears twitching with nerves.
When I played his lyre, the voices of those who had died and whose hair made the strings spoke to me. They were the true owners of the lyre. And when I destroyed it, I was saving them. They were trapped, you see.
Carden flops onto his throne, tipping back his head in frustration, knocking his crown askew.
Enough,
he says.
You are both thieves, and neither of you particularly skilled ones.
But you don't understand the torment, the screaming.
The deer boy presses a hand over his mouth, recalling himself in the presence of the High King.
Have you never heard that virtue is its own reward?
Carden says pleasantly.
That's because there's no other reward in it.
The boy scuffs his hoof on the floor.
You stole a lyre, and your lyre was stolen in turn,
Carden says softly.
There's some justice in that.
He turns to the grass-haired musician.
And you took matters in your own hands. So I can only assume they were arranged to your satisfaction. But both of you have irritated me. Give me that instrument.
Both look displeased, but the grass-haired musician comes forward and surrenders the lyre to a guard.
Each of you will have a chance to play it. And whosoever plays most sweetly, you will have it. For art is more than virtue or vice.
I make my careful way up the steps as the dear boy begins his playing. I didn't expect Cardin to care enough to hear out the musicians, and I can't decide if his judgment is brilliant or if he is just a jerk. I worry that, once again, I am reading what I want to be true into his actions. The music is haunting, thrumming across my skin and down to my bones. Your Majesty, I say, you sent for me?
Ah, yes.
His raven's wing hair falls over one eye.
So are we at war?
For a moment, I think he is talking about us. No, I say. At least not until the next full moon.
You can't fight the sea,
Locke says philosophically. Cardin gives a little laugh.
You can fight anything. Winning, though. That's something else again. Isn't that right, Jude?
Jude is a real winner,
Locke says with a grin. Then he looks out at the players and claps his hands.
Enough! Switch.
When Cardin doesn't contradict his master of revels, the dear boy reluctantly turns over the lyre to the grass-haired fairy. A fresh wash of music rushes through the hill, a wild tune to speed my heart. You were just going, I tell Locke. He grins.
I find I'm very comfortable here,
Locke says.
Surely there's nothing you have to say to the king that is so very personal or private.
It's a shame you'll never find out. Go. Now. I think about Randolin's advice. His reminder that I have power. Maybe I do. But I am still unable to get rid of a master of revels for a half hour. No less a grand general, who is also, more or less, my father.
Leave, Cardin tells Locke. I didn't summon her here for your pleasure.
You are most ungenerous. If you truly cared for me, you would have.
Locke says as he hops down from the dais. Take Taryn home, I call after him. If it wasn't for her, I would punch him right in the face.
He likes you this way, I think,
Cardin says,
flush-cheeked and furious.
I don't care what he likes, I spit out.
You seem to not care quite a lot.
His voice is dry, and when I look at him, I cannot read his face. Why am I here? I ask. He kicks his legs off the side of the throne and stands.
You.
He points to the dear boy.
Today, you are fortunate. Take the lyre. See that neither of you draw my notice again.
As the dear boy bows and the grass-haired fairy begins to sulk, Cardin turns to me.
Come.
Ignoring his high-handed manner with some difficulty, I follow him behind the throne and off the dais, where a small door is set against the stone wall, half hidden by ivy. I've never been here before. Cardin sweeps aside the ivy, and we go in. It is a small room, clearly intended for intimate meetings and assignations. Its walls are covered in moss, with small glowing mushrooms climbing them, casting a pale white light on us. There's a low couch, upon which people could sit or recline, as the situation called for. We are alone in a way we have not been alone for a long time, and when he takes a step toward me, my heart skips a beat. Cardin's eyebrows rise.
My brother sent me a message.
He unfolds it from his pocket. If you want to save your neck, pay me a visit, and put your seneschal on a leash.
So,
he says, holding it out to me.
What have you been about?
I let out a sigh of relief.
It didn't take long for Lady Asha to pass the information I gave her to Belkin. And it didn't take long for Belkin to act on it. One point to me. I stopped you from getting some messages, I admit.
And you decided not to mention them?
Cardin looks at me without particular rancor, but is not exactly pleased.
Just as you declined to tell me about Belkin's meetings with Orla, or Nikasia's plans for me.
Look, of course Belkin wants to see you, I say, trying to redirect the conversation away from his sadly incomplete list of stuff I haven't told him. You're his brother, whom he kept in his own house. You're the only person with the power to free him who might actually do it. I figured if you were in a forgiving mood, you could talk to him anytime you wanted. You didn't need his exhortations.
So what changed?
He asks, waving the piece of paper at me. Now he does sound angry.
Why was I permitted to receive this?
I gave him a source of information, I say. One it's possible for me to compromise.
And am I supposed to reply to this little note?
He asks. Have him brought to you in chains. I take the paper from him and jam it into my pocket. I'd be interested to know what he thinks he can get from you with a little conversation, especially since he doesn't know you're aware of his ties to the Undersea. Cardin's gaze narrows. The worst part is that I am deceiving him again, right now. Deceiving by omission. Hiding that my source of information, the one I can now compromise, is his own mother.
I thought you wanted me to do this on my own, I want to say. I thought I was supposed to rule, and you were supposed to be Mary. And that was supposed to be that. I suspect he will try to shout at me until I give him what he wants, Cardin says. It might be possible to goad him into letting something slip. Possible, not likely.
I nod, and the scheming part of my brain, honed on strategy games, supplies me with a move. Nikasia knows more than she's saying. Make her say the rest of it, and then use that against Belkin.
Yes, well, I don't think it would be politically expedient to put thumbscrews to a princess of the sea.
I look at him again, at his soft mouth and his high cheekbones, at the cruel beauty of his face. Not thumbscrews. You. You go to Nikasia and charm her. His eyebrows go up. Oh, come on, I say. The plan coming together in my mind as I am speaking. A plan that I hate as surely as I know it will be effective. You're practically draped in courtiers every time I see you.
I'm the king, he says.
They've been draped over you for longer than that. I'm frustrated having to explain this. Surely he's aware of the response of the folk to him. He makes an impatient gesture.
You mean, back when I was merely the prince?
Use your wiles, I say, exasperated and embarrassed. I'm sure you've got some. She wants you. It shouldn't be difficult. His eyebrows, if anything, climb higher.
You're seriously suggesting I do this?
I take a breath, realizing that I'm going to have to convince him that it will work, and that I know something that might. Nikasia's the one who came through the passageway and shot that girl you were kissing, I say.
You mean she tried to kill me?
He asks.
Honestly, Jude, how many secrets are you keeping?
I think of his mother again, and bite my tongue. Too many. She was shooting at the girl. Not you. She found you in bed with someone, got jealous, and shot twice. Unfortunately for you, but fortunately for everyone else. She's a terrible shot. Now do you believe me that she wants you?
I know not what to believe,
he says, clearly angry. Maybe at her, maybe at me,
probably at both of us.
She thought to surprise you in your bed. Give her what she wants, and get the information we need to avoid a war. He stalks toward me, close enough that I can feel his breath stirring my hair.
Are you commanding me?
No, I say, startled and unable to meet his gaze. Of course not. His fingers come to my chin, tilting my head so I am looking up into his black eyes, the rage in them as hot as coals.
You just think I ought to. That I can. That I'd be good at it. Very well, Jude. Tell me how it's done. Do you think she'd like it if I came to her like this? If I looked deeply into her eyes?
My whole body is alert, alive with sick desire, embarrassing in its intensity. He knows. I know he knows. Probably, I say, my voice coming out a little shakily. Whatever it is you usually do.
Oh, come now,
he says, his voice full of barely controlled fury.
If you want me to play the bawd, at least give me the benefit of your advice.
His beringed fingers trace over my cheek, trace the line of my lip, and down my throat. I feel dizzy and overwhelmed.
Should I touch her like this?
He asks, lashes lowered. The shadows limn his face, casting his cheekbones into stark relief. I don't know, I say, but my voice betrays me. It's all wrong, high and breathless. He presses his mouth to my ear, kissing me there. His hands skim over my shoulders, making me shiver.
And then like this? Is this how I ought to seduce her?
I can feel his mouth shape the light words against my skin.
Do you think it would work?
I dig my fingernails into the meat of my palm to keep from moving against him. My whole body is trembling with tension. Yes. Then his mouth is against mine, and my lips part. I close my eyes against what I'm about to do. My fingers reach up to tangle in the black curls of his hair. He doesn't kiss me as though he's angry. His kiss is soft, yearning. Everything slows, goes liquid and hot. I can barely think. I've wanted this, and feared it. And now that it's happening, I don't know how I will ever want anything else. We stumble back to the low couch. He leans me against the cushions, and I pull him down over me. His expression mirrors my own. Surprise, and a little horror.
Tell me again what you said at the revel,
he says, climbing over me, his body against mine. What? I can barely think.
That you hate me,
he says, his voice hoarse.
Tell me that you hate me.
I hate you, I say, the words coming out like a caress. I say it again, over and over. A litany, an enchantment, a ward against what I really feel. I hate you. I hate you. I hate you. He kisses me harder. I hate you. I breathe into his mouth. I hate you so much that sometimes I can't think of anything else. At that, he makes a harsh, low sound. One of his hands slides over my stomach, tracing the shape of my skin. He kisses me again, and it's like falling off a cliff, like a mountainslide, building momentum with every touch, until there is only crashing destruction ahead. I have never felt anything like this. He begins to unbutton my doublet, and I try not to freeze, try not to show my inexperience. I don't want him to stop. It feels like a gesh. It has all the sinister pleasure of sneaking out of the house, all the revolting satisfaction of stealing. It reminds me of the moment before I slammed a blade through my hand, amazed at my own capacity for self-betrayal. He leans up to pull off his own jacket, and I try to wriggle out of mine. He looks at me and blinks, as through a fog.
This is an absolutely terrible idea,
he says, with a kind of amazement in his voice. Yes, I tell him, kicking off my boots. I am wearing hose, and I don't think there's an elegant way to strip them off. Certainly, I don't find it. Tangled in the fabric, feeling foolish, I realize I could stop this now. I could gather up my things and go, but I don't. He shucks his cuffed white shirt over his head in a single elegant gesture, revealing bare skin and scars. My hands are shaking. He captures them and kisses my knuckles with a kind of reverence.
I want to tell you so many lies,
he says. I shudder, and my heart hammers as his hands skim over my skin, one sliding between my thighs. I mirror him, fumbling with the buttons of his breeches. He helps me push them down, his tail curling against his leg, then twisting to coil against mine, soft as a whisper. I reach over to slide my hand over the flat plane of his stomach. I don't let myself hesitate, but my inexperience is obvious. His skin is hot under my palm, against my calluses. His fingers are too clever by half. I feel as though I am drowning in sensation. His eyes are open, watching my flushed face, my ragged breathing. I try to stop myself from making embarrassing noises. It's more intimate than the way he's touching me, to be looked at like that. I hate that he knows what he's doing, and I don't. I hate being vulnerable. I hate that I throw my head back, baring my throat. I hate the way I cling to him, the nails of one hand digging into his back, my thoughts splintering, and the single last thing in my head, that I like him better than I've ever liked anyone, and that of all the things he's ever done to me, making me like him so much is by far the worst.
Chapter 16. One of the hardest things to do as a spy, as a strategist, or even just as a person, is wait. I recall the ghost's lessons, making me sit for hours with a crossbow in my hand without my mind wandering, waiting for the perfect shot. So much of winning is waiting. The other part, though, is taking the shot when it comes, unleashing all that momentum. In my rooms again, I remind myself of that. I can't afford to be distracted. Tomorrow, I need to get Vivi and Oak from the mortal world, and I need to come up with either a scheme better than Maddox, or a way to make Maddox's scheme safer for Oak. I concentrate on what I am going to say to Vivi, instead of thinking of Cardan. I do not want to consider what happened between us. I do not want to think about the way his muscles moved, or how his skin felt, or the soft gasping sounds he made, or the slide of his mouth against mine. I definitely don't want to think about how hard I had to bite my own lip to keep quiet, or how obvious it was that I'd never done any of the things we did, no less the things we didn't do. Every time I think of any of it, I shove the memory away as fiercely as possible. I shove it along with the enormous vulnerability I feel, the sensation of being exposed down to my raw nerves. I do not know how I will face Cardan again without behaving like a fool. If I cannot attack the problem of the Undersea, and I cannot attack the problem of Cardan, then perhaps I can take care of something else. It is a relief to don a suit of dark fabric and high leather boots, to holster blades at my wrists and calves. It is a relief to do something physical, heading through the woods and then sly-footing my way into a poorly guarded house. When one of the residents comes in, my knife is at his throat faster than he can speak. Locke, I say sweetly, are you surprised? He turns to me, dazzling smile faltering.
My blossom. What is this?
After an astonished moment, I realize he thinks I am Taryn. Can he really not tell the difference between us? A bitter pit where my heart should be is pleased by the thought.
If you think my sister would put a knife to your throat, perhaps you should delay your nuptials, I tell him, taking a step back and indicating a chair with the point. Go ahead. Sit. He sits down just as I kick the chair, sending it backward and him sprawling to the floor. He rolls over, glaring at me with indignation.
Unchivalrous, is all he says,
but there's something in his face that wasn't there before. Fear. For 5 months, I have tried to use every bit of restraint I learned over a lifetime of keeping my head down. I have tried to behave as though I had only dribs and drabs of power, an important servant's power, and still keep in my head that I was in charge, a balancing act that makes me think of Valmorin's lesson in juggling. I have allowed the lock situation to get out of hand. I place my foot on his chest, pressing down a little, to remind him that if I kicked hard, it could shatter bone. I am done with being polite. We're not going to play word games or make up riddles. Humiliating the High King is a bad idea. Humiliating me is a terrible idea. Running around on my sister is just dumb. Maybe you thought I was too busy to take my revenge. Well, Locke, I want you to understand that for you, I will make time. His face pales. He's obviously not sure what to make of me right now. He knows I stabbed Valyrian once, but he doesn't know I killed him, nor that I have killed since then. He has no idea I became a spy, and then a spy master. Even the sword fight with Taryn was something he only heard about.
Making you Queen of Mirth was a jest,
Locke says, gazing up at me from the floor with a kind of fondness in his fox eyes, a little smile on the corner of his mouth, as though he's willing me to grin along with him.
Come on, Jude, let me up. Am I really to believe you'd harm me?
My voice is mock sweet. He once accused me of playing the great game. What was it you called it? The game of kings and princes, of queens and crowns. But to play it well, I must be pitiless. He begins to get up, but I press down harder with my foot and shift the grip on my knife. He stops moving. You always liked stories, I remind him. You said you wanted to create the sparks of stories. Well, the tale of a twin who murders her sister's betrothed is a good one, don't you think? He closes his eyes and holds out his empty hands.
Peace, Jude. Perhaps I overplayed my hand, but I cannot believe you want to murder me for it. Your sister would be devastated.
Better she never be a bride than wind up a widow, I say, but take my foot off his chest. He gets up slowly, dusting himself off, once on his feet. He looks around the room as though he doesn't quite recognize his own manner, now that he's seen it from the vantage of the floor. You're right, I continue. I don't want to harm you. We are to be family. You will be my brother, and I your sister. Let us make friends. But to do that, I need you to do some things for me. First, stop trying to make me uncomfortable. Stop trying to turn me into a character in one of your dramas. Pick another target to weave stories around. Second, whatever your issue is with Cardin, whatever pushed you to make such a meal of toying with him, whatever made you think it was fun to steal his lover and then throw her over for a mortal girl, as though you wanted him to know the thing dearest to him was worth nothing to you, let it go. Whatever made you decide to make me Queen of Mirth, to torment him with the feelings you suspected he had, leave off. He's the High King, and it's too dangerous.
Dangerous,
he says,
but fun.
I don't smile. Humiliate the king before the court, and the courtiers will spread rumors, and his subjects will forget to be afraid. Soon, the lesser courts will think they can go against him. Locke tries to right the broken chair, leaning it against a nearby table when it becomes clear it will no longer stand on its own.
Oh, fine. You're angry with me. But think, you may be Cardin Seneschal, and you've obviously fascinated him with your hips and lips and warm mortal skin. But I know that in your heart, whatever he has promised you, you still hate him. You'd love to see him brought low in front of his entire court. Why, if you hadn't been dressed in rags and been laughed at, you'd probably have forgiven me for every wrongdoing I've ever committed against you, just for engineering that.
You're wrong, I say. He smiles.
Liar.
Even if I did like it, I say, it must end. He seems to be evaluating how serious I am, and of what I am capable. I am sure he is seeing the girl he brought home, the one he kissed and tricked. He is wondering, probably not for the first time, how I lucked into being made seneschal, how I managed to get my hands on the crown of Elfheim to orchestrate my little brother's putting it on Cardin's head. The last thing is this, I say. You're going to keep faith with Taryn. Once you're wed, if you want to take other lovers, she better be with you when you do it, and she better be into it. If it's not fun for everyone, it's not happening. He stares at me blankly.
Are you accusing me of not caring for your sister?
He asks. If I truly believed you didn't care for Taryn, we wouldn't be having this conversation. He gives a long sigh.
Because you'd murder me?
If you're playing with Taryn, Matic will murder you. I won't even get a chance. I sheathe my knife and head toward the door.
Your ridiculous family might be surprised to find that not everything is solved by murder,
Locke calls after me. We would be surprised to find that, I call back. Chapter 17. In the 5 months that Vivi and Oak have been gone, I have visited the mortal world only twice, once to help them set up their apartment, and the second time for a wine party Heather threw for Vivi's birthday. At it, Taryn and I sat awkwardly on the edge of a couch, eating cheese with oily olives, being allowed little sips of Shiraz by college girls because we were too young to legally drink. My nerves were on edge the whole night, wondering what trouble was happening in my absence. Matic had sent Vivi a present, and Taryn had faithfully carried it across the sea, a golden dish of salt that never emptied. Turn it over, and it's full again. I found it to be a nervous-making present, but Heather had only laughed, as though it was some kind of novelty with a trick bottom. She didn't believe in magic. How Heather was going to react to Taryn's wedding was anyone's guess. All I hoped was that Vivienne had warned her about at least some of what was going to happen. Otherwise, the news that mermaids were real was going to come along with the news that mermaids were out to get us. I didn't think all at once was the ideal way to hear any of that news. After midnight, the Roach and I go across the sea in a boat made of river rushes and breath. We carry a cargo of mortals who have been tunneling out new rooms in the Court of Shadows. Taken from their beds just after dusk, they will be returned just before dawn. When they wake, they will find gold coins scattered in their sheets and filling their pockets. Not fairy gold, which blows away like dandelion puffs off leaves and stones, but real gold. A month's wages for a single stolen night. You might think I am heartless to allow this. No less order it. Maybe I am. But they made a bargain, even if they didn't understand with whom they were making it. And I can promise that besides the gold, all they are left with in the morning is exhaustion. They will not remember their journey to Elfheim, and we will not take them twice. On the trip over, they sit quietly on the boat,
lost in dreams as the swells of the sea and the wind propel us whitherward. Overhead, Snapdragon keeps pace, looking for trouble. I gaze at the waves and think of Nikasia. Imagine webbed hands on the sides of the vessel. Imagine sea folk clawing their way aboard.
You can't fight the sea, Locke said. I hope he's wrong.
Near the shore, I climb out, stepping into the shock of icy water at my calves and black rocks under my feet, then clamber over them, leaving the boat to come apart as the roach's magic fades from it. Snapdragon heads off to the east to scout for future workers. The roach and I put each mortal to bed. Occasionally beside a sleeping lover, we take care not to wake as we ply them with gold. I feel like a fairy in a story, sly-footing my way through homes, able to drink the cream off the milk or put knots in a child's hair.
This is usually a lonely business, the roach says when we're finished. Your company was a pleasure. There's hours yet between dawn and waking. Come sup with me.
It's true that it's still too early to pick up Vivi and Heather and Oak. It's also true that I am hungry. I have a tendency these days to put off eating until I am ravenous. I feel a little like a snake, either starved or swallowing a mouse whole. Okay. The roach suggests we go to a diner. I do not tell him I've never been to one. Instead, I follow him through the woods. We come out near a highway. Across the road rests a building, brightly lit and shiny with chrome. Beside it is a sign, proclaiming it to be open 24 hours. And the parking lot is enormous, big enough even for several trucks already parked there. This early in the morning, there is barely any traffic, and we are able to cross the highway easily. Inside, I slide obediently into the booth he chooses. He snaps his fingers, and the little box beside our table springs to life, blaring music. I flinch, surprised, and he laughs. A waitress comes by the table, a pen with a thoroughly chewed cap stuck behind her ear, like in the movies. Something to drink? She says, the words running together so that it takes a moment to understand she's asked a question.
Coffee, the roach says, black as the eyes of the High King of Elfheim.
The waitress just stares at him for a long blink, then scratches something on her pad and turns to me. Same, I say, not sure what else they have. When she's gone, I open the menu and look at the pictures. It turns out they have everything. Piles of food. Chicken wings, bright and gleaming with glaze beside little pots of white sauce. A pile of chopped potatoes, fried to a turn, topped with crisped sausages and bubbling eggs. Wheat cakes larger than my spread hand, buttered and glistening with syrup.
Did you know?
The roach inquires.
Your people once believed the folk came and took the wholesomeness out of mortal food?
Did they? I ask with a grin. He shrugs.
Some tricks may be lost to time, but I grant that mortal food does possess a great deal of substance.
The waitress comes back with hot coffees, and I warm my hands on the cup, while the roach orders fried pickles and buffalo wings, a burger, and a milkshake. I order an omelet with mushrooms and something called pepper jack cheese. We sit in silence for a time. I watch the roach rip sugar packets and dump them into his cup. I don't do anything to mine. I'm used to the whipped cream-topped drinks Vivi used to bring me. But there is something satisfyingly bracing about drinking coffee this way. Hot and bitter. Black as the eyes of the King of Elfheim.
So,
says the roach,
when will you tell the king about his mother?
She doesn't want me to, I say. The roach frowns.
You've made improvements in the Court of Shadows. You're young, but you're ambitious in the way that perhaps only the young can be. I judge you by three things and three things only. How square you are with us, how capable, and what you want for the world.
Where does Lady Asha come into any of that? I ask.
just as the waitress returns with our food. Because I can already sense that she does. You didn't open with that question for nothing. My omelet is enormous, an entire henhouse of eggs. My mushrooms are identically shaped, as though someone had ground up real mushrooms and then made cookie-cutter versions. They taste that way, too. With the roaches' food piled up on the other side, soon the table is full to groaning. He takes a bite of a wing and licks his lips with his black tongue.
Cardin is part of the Court of Shadows. We may play the world, but we don't play one another. Hiding messages from Baelkin is one thing, but his mother? Does he even know she's not dead?
You're writing a tragedy for him without cause, I say. We have no reason to believe he doesn't know. And he's not one of us. He's no spy. The roach bites off the last piece of gristle from the chicken bones, cracking it between his teeth. He's finished the whole plate of them and, pushing it aside, starts on the pickles.
You made a bargain for me to train him, and I've taken him under my wing. Sleight of hand, pickpocketing, little magics. He's good at it.
I think of the coin playing across his long fingers while he slouched in the burnt remains of his rooms. I glare at the roach. He only laughs.
Don't look at me like that. 'Twas you who made the bargain.
I barely recall that part. So intent was I on getting Cardin to agree to a year and a day of service. So long as he pledged to me, I could put him on the throne. I would have promised him much more than lessons in spycraft. But when I think of the night he was shot at, the night he did coin tricks, I can't help recalling him gazing up from my bed, intoxicated, and disturbingly intoxicating. Kiss me until I am sick of it.
And now he's play-acting, isn't he?
The roach goes on.
Because if he's the true High King of Elfheim, whom we are to follow to the end of days, then we've been a mite disrespectful, running the kingdom for him. But if he is play-acting, then he's a spy for sure, and better than most of us, which makes him part of the Shadow Court.
I drink down my coffee in a scalding swallow. We can't talk about this.
Not at home we can't,
the roach says with a wink.
Which is why we're here.
I asked him to seduce Nikasia. Yes, I guess I have been a mite disrespectful to the High King of Elfheim. And the roach is right. Cardin didn't behave as though he was too royal for my request. That wasn't his reason for taking offense. Fine, I say in defeat. I'll figure out a way to tell him. The roach grins.
The food's good here, right? Sometimes I miss the mortal world. But for good or ill, my work in Elfheim is not yet done.
Hopefully for good, I say, and take a bite of the shredded potato cake that came with my omelet. The roach snorts. He's moved on to his milkshake, the other plates bare and stacked up to one side of him. He lifts his mug in a salute.
To the triumph of goodness. Just not before we get ours.
I want to ask you something, I say, clinking my mug against his. About the bomb.
Leave her out of this,
he says, studying me.
And if you can, leave her out of your schemes against the Undersea. I know you're always sticking your neck out as though you're enamored of the axe, but if there must be a neck on the chopping block beside you, choose a less comely one.
Including your own? I ask.
Much better,
he agrees. Because you love her? I ask. The roach frowns at me.
And if I did? Would you lie to me about my chances?
No, I begin. But he cuts me off.
I love a good lie,
he says, standing and setting down little stacks of silver coins on the table.
I love a good liar even better, which is to your benefit. But some lies are not worth the telling.
I bite my lip, unable to say anything else without spilling the bomb's secrets. After the diner, we part ways, both of us with ragwort in our pockets. I watch him go, thinking of his claim on Cardin, I had been trying so hard not to think of him as the rightful High King of Elfheim that I had entirely missed asking myself whether he considered himself to be High King, and, if he didn't, whether that meant he thought of himself as one of my spies instead. I make my way to my sister's apartment, though in the past I've donned mortal clothing to walk around the mall and tried to behave in such a way as would be above suspicion. It turns out that arriving in Maine in a doublet and riding boots draws a few stares, but no fear that I have come from another world. Perhaps I am part of a medieval festival, a girl suggests as I pass her. She went to one a few years ago and enjoyed the joust very much. She had a large turkey leg and tried mead for the first time. It goes to your head, I tell her. She agrees. An elderly man with a newspaper remarks that I must be doing Shakespeare in the Park. A few louts on some steps call out to me that Halloween is in October. The folk doubtlessly learned this lesson long ago. They do not need to deceive humans. Humans will deceive themselves. It is with this, fresh in my mind, that I cross a lawn full of dandelions, go up the steps to my sister's door, and knock. Heather opens it. Her pink hair is freshly dyed for the wedding. For a moment, she looks taken aback, probably by my outfit, and then smiles, opening the door wide.
Hi! Thanks for being willing to drive. Everything's mostly packed. Is your car big enough?
Definitely, I lie, looking around the kitchen for Vivi with a kind of desperation. How is my big sister thinking this is going to go if she hasn't told Heather anything? If she believes I have a car instead of ragwort stocks.
Jude!
Oak yells, hopping down from his seat at the table. He throws his arms around me.
Can we go? Are we going? I made everyone presents at school.
Let's see what Vivi says, I tell him, and give him a squeeze. He's more solid than I remembered. Even his horn seems slightly longer, although he can't have grown that much in just a few months. Can he? Heather throws a switch, and the coffee pot starts chugging away. Oak climbs onto a chair and pours candy-colored cereal into a bowl and begins eating it dry. I sidle past and head into the next room. There's Heather's desk, piled with sketches and markers and paints. Prints of her work are taped to the wall above. Besides making comics, Heather works part-time at a copy shop to help cover bills. She believes Vivi has a job too, which may or may not be a fiction. There are jobs for the folk in the mortal world, just not the sort of jobs one tells one's human girlfriend about. Especially if one has conveniently never mentioned one isn't human. Their furniture is a collection of stuff from garage sales, salvage places, and the side of the road. Covering the walls are old plates with funny, big-eyed animals, cross stitches with ominous phrases, and Heather's collection of disco memorabilia, more of her art, and Oak's crayon drawings. In one, Vivi and Heather and Oak are together, rendered as he sees them. Heather's brown skin and pink hair, Vivi's pale skin and cat eyes, Oak's horns. I bet Heather thinks it's adorable, how Oak made himself and Vivi into monsters. I bet she thinks it's a sign of his creativity. This is going to suck. I am prepared for Heather to yell at my sister. Vivi more than deserves it. But I don't want Heather to hurt Oak's feelings. I find Vivi in her bedroom, still packing. It is small by comparison to the rooms we grew up in, and much less tidy than the rest of the apartment. Her clothes are everywhere. Scarves are draped over the headboard, bangles threaded on the pole of the footboard, shoes peeking out from underneath the bed. I sit down on the mattress. Where does Heather think she's going today? Vivi gives me a big grin.
You got my message. Looks like it's possible to enchant birds to do useful things after all.
You don't need me, I remind her. You are perfectly capable of making all the ragwort horses you could ever need.
Something I can't do.
Heather believes we are attending the wedding of my sister Taryn,
which we are, on an island off the coast of Maine, which we also are. See? Not a single lie was told.
I begin to understand why I was roped in.
And when she wanted to drive, you said your sister would come pick you up. Well, she assumed there would be a ferry, and I could hardly agree or disagree with that,
Vivi says, with a breezy honesty that I've always liked and also been exasperated with. And now you're going to have to tell the truthier truth, I say.
Or, I have a proposal.
Don't. Keep putting it off. Don't come to the wedding.
Maddox said you'd say that,
she tells me, frowning. It's too dangerous. For complicated reasons I know you don't care about, I say. The Queen of the Undersea wants her daughter to marry Carden, and she's working with Baelkin, who has his own agenda. She's probably playing him, but since she's better at being worse than him, that's not good.
You're right, Vivi says. I don't care. Politics are boring.
Oak is in danger, I say. Maddox wants to use him as bait.
There's always danger, Vivi says, throwing a pair of boots on top of some crumpled dresses. Ferry is one big mousetrap of danger. But if I let that keep us away, how could I look my stalwart father in the face? Not to mention my stalwart sister, who is going to keep us safe while father schemes his schemes, Vivi continues. At least, according to him.
I groan, just like him to cast me in a role I can't deny, but which serves his purpose, and just like her to ignore me and believe that she knows best. Someone you trust has already betrayed you. I have trusted Vivi more than anyone else. I have trusted her with Oak, with the truth, with my plan. I have trusted her because she is my older sister, because she doesn't care about Fairy. But it occurs to me that if she betrayed me, I would be undone. I wish she wouldn't keep reminding me she was talking to Maddox.
And you trust Dad? That's a change. He's not good at a lot of things, but he knows about scheming, Vivi says, which is not that reassuring. Come on, tell me about Taryn. Is she actually excited?
How do I even answer?
Locke got himself made Master of Revels.
She's not exactly pleased with his new title or behavior.
I think half the reason he likes to screw around is to get under her skin. This is not boring, Vivi says. Go on.
Heather comes into the room with two cups of coffee. We stop talking as she passes one to me and one to Vivi.
I didn't know how you took it, she says. So I made it like V's.
I take a sip. It's very sweet. I've already had plenty of coffee this morning, but I drink some more anyway. Black as the eyes of the High King of Elfheim.
Heather leans against the door. You done packing? Almost. Vivi eyes her suitcase and then throws in a pair of rain boots. Then she looks around the room, as though she's wondering what other stuff she can cram in. Heather frowns.
You're bringing all that for a week?
It's just the top layer that's clothes, Vivi says. Underneath, it's mostly stuff for Taryn that's hard to get on the island.
Do you think what I'm planning on wearing will be okay?
I can understand why Heather is worried, since she's never met my family. She believes our dad is strict. She has no idea.
Sure, Vivi says, and then looks at me. It's a hot silver dress.
Wear anything you want, really, I tell Heather, thinking of how gowns and rags and nakedness are all acceptable in Fairy. She's about to have much bigger problems.
Hurry up. We don't want to get stuck in traffic, Heather says,
and goes out again. In the other room, I hear her talking to Oak, asking him if he wants some milk.
So, Vivi says, you were saying?
I let out a long sigh and gesture with my coffee cup toward the door, bugging out my eyes. Vivi shakes her head.
Come on. You won't be able to tell me any of this once we're there.
You know already, I say. Locke is going to make Taryn unhappy,
but she doesn't want to hear that, and she especially doesn't want to hear it from me.
You did once have a sword fight over him, Vivi points out.
Exactly, I say. I'm not objective. Or I don't seem objective.
You know what I wonder about, though?
She says, closing her suitcase and sitting on it to squish it down. She looks up at me with her cat eyes, twin to Maddox.
You've manipulated the High King of Faerie into obeying you. But you can't find a way to manipulate one jerk into keeping our sister happy?
Not fair, I want to say. Practically the last thing I did before I came here was threaten Locke, ordering him not to mess with Taryn after they got married. Or else. Still, her words rankle. It's not that simple. She sighs.
I guess nothing ever is.
Chapter 18. Oak holds my hand, and I carry his small suitcase down the steps toward the empty parking lot. I look back up at Heather. She's dragging a bag behind her, and some bungee cords she says we can use if we have to put one of the suitcases on the roof rack. I haven't told her there isn't even a car. So, I say, looking at Vivi. Vivi smiles, reaching out her hand toward me. I take the ragwort stalks out of my pocket and hand them over. I can't look at Heather's face. I turn back to Oak. He's picking four-leaf clovers from the grass, finding them effortlessly, making a bouquet.
What are you doing?
Heather asks, puzzled.
We're not going to take a car. We're going to fly instead, says Vivi. We're going to the airport?
Vivi laughs.
You'll love this. Steed, rise and bear us where I command.
A choked gasp behind me. Then Heather screams. I turn despite myself. The ragwort steeds are there in front of the apartment complex, starved-looking yellow ponies with lacy manes and emerald eyes, like seahorses on land. Weeds come to snorting, snuffling life. And Heather, hands over her mouth.
Surprise, says Vivi,
continuing to behave as though this is a small thing. Oak, clearly anticipating this moment, chooses it to rip off his own glamour, revealing his horns.
See, Heather, he says, we're magic. Are you surprised?
She looks at Oak, at the monstrous ragwort ponies, and then sinks down to sit on her suitcase.
Okay, she says. This is some kind of bullshit practical joke or something, but one of you is going to tell me what's going on, or I am going to go back inside the house and lock you all out.
Oak looks crestfallen. He'd really expected her to be delighted. I put my arm around him, rubbing his shoulder. Come on, sweets, I say. Let's get the stuff loaded up. And they can come after. Mom and Dad are so excited to see you.
I miss them, he tells me. I miss you too.
I kiss him on one soft cheek as I lift him onto the horse's back. He looks over my shoulder at Heather. Behind me, I can hear Vivi start to explain.
Fairy is real. Magic is real. See? I'm not human. And neither is my brother. And we're going to take you away to a magic island for the whole week. Don't be afraid. We are not the scary ones.
I manage to get the bungee cords from Heather's numb hands while Vivi shows off her pointed ears and cat eyes and tries to explain away never telling her any of it before. We are definitely the scary ones. Some hours later, we are in Oriana's parlor. Heather, still looking bewildered and upset, walks around, staring at the strange art on the walls, the ominous pattern of beetles and thorns in the weave of draperies. Oak sits on Oriana's lap, letting her cradle him in her arms as though he is very small again. Her pale fingers fuss with his hair, which she thinks is too short, and he tells her a long, rambling story about school and the way the stars are different in the mortal world and what peanut butter tastes like. It hurts a little to watch, because Oriana no more gave birth to Oak than to me or Taryn, but she is very clearly Oak's mother, while she has steadfastly refused to be ours.
Vivi pulls presents from her suitcase. Bags of coffee beans, glass earrings in the shape of little leaves, tins of dulce de leche. Heather walks over to me.
This is all real?
Really, really real, I confirm.
And it's true that these people are elves, that V is an elf, like from a story?
Heather looks around the room again, warily, as though she is expecting a rainbow-colored unicorn to burst through the plaster and laugh.
Yep,
I say. She seems freaked out, but not actually angry at Vivi, which is something. Maybe the news is too big for anger, at least yet. Or maybe Heather's honestly pleased. Maybe Vivi was right about the way to tell her, and it was only that the delight took a few minutes to kick in. What do I know about love?
And this place is...
She stops herself.
Oak is some kind of prince? He's got horns. And Vivi has those eyes.
Cat eyes like her father, I say. It's a lot, I'm sure.
He sounds scary,
Heather says.
Your dad. Sorry, I mean, V's dad. She says he's not really your father.
I flinch, although I'm sure Vivi didn't mean it that way. Maybe she didn't even say it that way.
Because you're human, Heather tries to clarify. You are human, right?
I nod, and the relief on her face is clear. She laughs a little. It's not easy to be human and fairy, I tell her. Come walk with me. I want to tell you some stuff. She tries to catch Vivi's eye, but Vivi is still sitting on the rug, rooting through her suitcase. I see more trinkets, packages of licorice, hair ribbons, and a large package covered in white paper with a golden bow, stamped with congratulations all along its length. Unsure what else to do, Heather follows me. Vivi doesn't even seem to notice. It is strange to be back in the house where I grew up, tempting to run up the stairs and throw open the doors to my old room, to see if there's any trace of me there. Tempting to go into Maddox's study and go through his papers like the spy that I am. Instead, I head out onto the lawn and start toward the stables. Heather takes a deep breath. Her eyes are drawn to the towers visible above the tree line. Did V talk to you about rules? I ask as we walk. Heather shakes her head, clearly puzzled.
Rules?
Vivi has come through for me plenty of times when no one else did, so I know she cares. Still, it feels like willful blindness to have overlooked how hard Taryn and I had it as mortals, how careful we had to be, and how careful Heather ought to be while she's here.
She said I should stick by her, Heather says,
probably seeing the frustration on my face and wanting to defend Vivi.
That I shouldn't wander off without one of her family members.
I shake my head. Not good enough. Listen, the folk can glamour things to look different than they do. They can mess with your mind, charm you, persuade you to do things you wouldn't consider normally. And then there's Everapple, the fruit of fairy. If you taste it, all you'll think of is getting more. I sound like Oriana. Heather is looking at me in horror and possibly disbelief. I wonder if I went too far. I try again with a slightly calmer tone. We're at a disadvantage here. The folk, they're ageless, immortal, and magical. And they're not all fond of humans. So don't let your guard down. Don't make any bargains. And keep some specific things on your person at all times. Rowan berries and salt.
Okay, she says.
In the distance, I can see Maddox's two riding toads out on the lawn, being tended by grooms. You're taking this really well, I say.
I have two questions.
Something in her voice or her manner
makes me realize she is maybe having a harder time than I thought. One, what are Rowan berries? And two, if Fairyland is the way you say, why do you live here? I open my mouth and then shut it. It's home, I say finally.
It doesn't have to be, she says. If V can leave, so can you. Like you said, you're not one of them.
Come to the kitchens, I tell her, veering back toward the house. Once there, Heather is transfixed by the enormous cauldron, big enough for both of us to bathe in. She stares at the plucked bodies of partridges, resting on the counter beside dough rolled out for a pie. I go over to the glass jars of herbs and draw out a few rowan berries. I take out a thick thread for sewing stuffing inside hens, and I use that and a bit of cheesecloth to make her a small knot of them. Put this in your pocket or in your bra, I tell her. Keep it on you while you're here.
And this will keep me safe? Heather asks.
Safer, I say, sewing her up a bag of salt. Sprinkle this on whatever you eat. Don't forget.
Thank you.
She takes my arm, giving it a quick squeeze.
I mean, this doesn't feel real.
I know this must sound ridiculous. I'm standing in front of you. I can smell herbs and blood from those weird little birds.
If you stuck me with that needle, it would hurt. But it still doesn't feel real. Even though it makes sense of all of these stupid evasions about normal stuff like where she went to high school. But it means the whole world is upside down.
When I've been over there, at the mall, in Heather's apartment, the difference between them and us has seemed so vast that I can't imagine how Heather is managing to bridge it. Nothing you could say would sound ridiculous to me, I tell her. Her gaze, as she takes in the stronghold, as she drinks in a breath of late afternoon air, is full of hopeful interest. I have an uncomfortable memory of a girl with stones in her pockets, and am desperately relieved that Heather is willing to accept her world being turned over. Back in the parlor, Vivi grins at us.
Did Jude give you the grand tour?
I made her a charm, I say, my tone making it clear that she should have been the one to do it.
Good,
Vivi says happily, because it's going to take much more than a slightly aggrieved tone to get under her skin when things are going her way.
Oriana tells me you haven't been around much lately. Your feud with dear old dad sounds pretty serious.
You know what it cost him, I say.
Stay for dinner.
Oriana rises, pale as a ghost, to look at me with her ruby eyes.
Maddock would like that. I would too.
I can't, I tell her, actually feeling regretful about it. I've dallied here more than I should have, but I will see you all at the wedding.
Things are always super dramatic around here, Vivi tells Heather. Epic. Everyone acts as though they've just stepped out of a murder ballad.
Heather looks at Vivi as though, perhaps, she'd just stepped out of a ballad too.
Oh,
Vivi says, reaching into her suitcase again, coming up with another squishy-looking package wrapped with a black bow.
Can you take this to Cardin? It's a congratulations on being king present.
He's the High King of Elfheim, Oriana says. Whether or not you played together, you cannot call him as you did when you were children.
I stand there stupidly for a long moment, not reaching for the package. I knew Vivi and Cardin were friendly. After all, Vivi's the one who told Taryn about his tale, having seen it while swimming together with one of his sisters. I just forgot.
Jude?
Vivi asks. I think you better give it to him yourself, I say. And with that, I make my escape from my old house before Maddock returns home, and I am overcome with nostalgia. I pass by the throne room where Cardin sits at one of the low tables, his head bent toward Nikasia's. I cannot see his face, but I can see hers as she throws back her head with laughter, showing the long column of her throat. She looks incandescent with joy,
his attention the light in which her beauty shines especially bright. She loves him, I realize uncomfortably. She loves him, and she betrayed him with Locke, and is terrified he will never love her again. His fingers trace their way down her arm to the back of her wrist, and I remember vividly the feeling of those hands on me. My skin heats at the memory, a blush that starts at my throat and keeps going from there. "Kiss me until I am sick of it," he said. And now he has most certainly gorged on my kisses. Now he is most certainly sick of them. I hate seeing him with Nikasia. I hate the thought of his touching her. I hate that this is my plan, that I have no one to be angry with but myself. I am an idiot. Pain makes you strong, Matic once told me, making me lift a sword again and again. Get used to the weight. I force myself to watch no more. Instead, I meet with Vulsiber to coordinate bringing Bilk into the palace for his audience with Cardin. Then I go down to the Court of Shadows and hear information about courtiers. Hear rumors of Maddox marshaling his forces as though preparing for the war I still hope to avoid. I send 2 spies to the lower courts with the largest number of unsworn changelings to see what they can learn. I talk to the Balm about Grimson, who has crafted Nikasia a gem-encrusted brooch that allows her to summon gauzy wings from her back and fly. What do you think he wants? I ask.
Praise. Flattery, says the Balm. Perhaps to find a new patron. Probably he wouldn't mind a kiss.
Do you think he's interested in Nikasia for Orla's sake, or her own? I want to know. The Balm shrugs.
He is interested in Nikasia's beauty and Orla's power. Grimson went into exile with the first Alder King. I believe the next time he swears fealty, he will be very sure of the monarch to whom he swears.
Or maybe he doesn't want to swear fealty ever again, I say, determining to pay him a visit. Grimson chose to live as well as work in the old forge Cardin gave him, though it was overgrown with rose bushes and not in the best repair. A thin plume of smoke spirals up from the chimney as I approach. I rap 3 times on the door and wait. A few moments later, he opens the door, letting out a blast of heat, hot enough for me to take a step back.
I know you, he says.
Queen of Mirth, I acknowledge, getting it out of the way. He laughs, shaking his head.
I knew your mortal father. He made a knife for me once. Traveled all the way to Fairfold to ask me what I thought of it.
And what did you think? I wonder if this was before Justin arrived at Elfheim. Before my mother.
He had real talent. I told him if he practiced for 50 years, he might make the greatest blade ever made by a mortal man. I told him that if he practiced for 100 years, he might craft one of the finest blades made by anyone. None of it satisfied him. Then I told him that I would give him one of my secrets. He could learn the practice of 100 years in a single day. If only he would make a bargain with me. If only he would part with something he didn't want to lose.
And did he make the bargain? I ask. He appears delighted.
Oh, wouldn't you like to know? Come in.
With a sigh, I do. The heat is nearly unbearable, and the stink of metal overwhelms my senses. In the dim room, what I see most is fire. My hand goes to the knife in my sleeve. Thankfully, we move through the forge and into the living quarters of the house. It is untidy, all the surfaces littered with beautiful things. Gems, jewelry, blades, and other ornaments. He pulls out a small wooden chair for me, and then sits on a low bench. He has a worn, leathery face, and his silvery hair stands on end, as though he has been tugging on it as he worked. Today, he is not clad in jeweled jackets. He wears a worn leather smock over a gray shirt smeared with ash. 7 heavy gold hoops hang from his large, pointed ears.
"What brings you to my forge?"
he asks. "I was hoping to find a gift for my sister. She is getting married in just a few days."
"Something special, then," he says.
"I know you are a legendary smith," I tell him. "So I thought it was possible you no longer sold your wares."
"No matter my fame, I am still a tradesman,"
he says, covering his heart. He looks pleased to be flattered.
"But it is true that I no longer deal in coins, only in barter."
I should have figured there was some trick. Still, I blink at him, all innocence. "What can I give you that you don't already have?"
"Let us find out," he says. "Tell me about your sister. Is this a love match?"
"It must be," I say, thinking that over, since there's no practical value in it. His eyebrows rise.
"Yes, I see. And does your sister resemble you?"
"We are twins," I say.
"Blue stones, then, for your coloring," he says. "Perhaps a necklace of tears to weep, so that she won't have to? A pin of teeth to bite annoying husbands? No."
He continues to walk through the small space. He lifts a ring.
"To bring on a child?"
And then, seeing my face, lifts a pair of earrings, one in the shape of a crescent moon, and the other in the shape of a star.
"Ah, yes. Here, this is what you want."
"What do they do?" I ask. He laughs.
"They are beautiful. Isn't that enough?"
I give him a skeptical look. It would be enough, considering how exquisite they are. But I bet it isn't all. He enjoys that.
"Clever girl. They are not only beautiful, but they add to beauty. They make someone more lovely than they were. Painfully lovely. Her husband will not leave her side for quite some time."
The look on his face is a challenge. He believes I am too vain to give such a gift to my sister. How well he knows the selfish human heart. Taryn will be a beautiful bride. How much more do I, her twin, want to put myself in her shadow? How lovely can I bear her to be? And yet, what better gift for a human girl wedded to the beauty of the folk? "What would you take for them?" I ask.
"Oh, any number of little things. A year of your life. The luster of your hair. The sound of your laugh."
"My laugh is not such a sweet sound as all that."
"Not sweet. But I bet it's rare,"
he says. And I wonder at his knowing that. "What about my tears?" I ask. "You could make another necklace." He looks at me, as though evaluating how often I weep.
"I will take a single tear,"
he says finally.
"And you will take an offer to the High King for me."
"What kind of offer?" I counter.
"It is known that the Undersea has threatened the land. Tell your king that if he declares war, I will make him armor of ice to shatter every blade that strikes it, and that will make his heart too cold to feel pity. Tell him I will make him 3 swords that, when used in the same battle, will fight with the might of 30 soldiers.
I am shocked. "I will tell him. But why would you want that?" He grimaces, taking out a cloth to polish the earrings.
"I have a reputation to rebuild, my lady. And not just as a maker of trinkets. Once kings and queens came to me as supplicants. Once I forged crowns and blades to change the world. It stands within the High King's power to restore my fame. And it stands within my power to add to his power."
"What happens if he likes the world the way it is?" I ask. "Unchanged." He gives a little laugh.
"Then I will make you a little glass in which to suspend time."
The tear is taken out of the corner of my eye with a long siphon. Then I leave, holding Taryn's earrings, and more questions. Back in my own rooms, I hold the jewels to my own ears. Even in the mirror, They make my eyes look liquid and luminous. My mouth seems redder. My skin glows as though I have just risen from a bath. I wrap them up before I think better of it.
Chapter 19. I spend the rest of the night in the Court of Shadows, preparing plans to keep Oak safe. Winged guards who can sweep him up into the air if he is lured by the delights of the waves he once played in. A spy disguised as a nanny to follow him and dote on him and sample anything before he can taste it. Archers in the trees, the tips of their arrows trained on anyone who comes too close to my brother. As I am trying to anticipate what Orla might do and how to know as soon as it happens, there's a knock on my door. Yes, I call, and Cardin walks in. I jerk to my feet in surprise. I don't expect him to be here, but he is, dressed in disarranged finery. His lips are slightly swollen. His hair must. He looks as though he came straight from a bed and not his own. He tosses a scroll down on my desk. Well, I ask, my voice coming out as cold as I could ever wish.
You were right,
he says, and it sounds like an accusation. What, I ask. He leans against the door jamb.
Nikasia gave up her secrets. All it took was some kindness and a few kisses.
Our eyes meet. If I look away, then he will know I am embarrassed. But I fear he can tell anyway. My cheeks go hot. I wonder if I will ever be able to look at him again, without remembering what it was like to touch him.
Orla will act during the wedding of Locke and your sister.
I sit back down in my chair, looking at all the notes in front of me.
You're sure?
He nods.
Nikasia said that as mortal power grows, land and sea ought to be united, and that they would be, either in the way she hoped, or the way I should fear.
Ominous, I say.
It seems I have a singular taste for women who threaten me.
I cannot think of what to say to that. So instead I tell him about Grimson's offer to forge him armor and swords to carry him to victory, so long as you're willing to fight the Undersea.
He wants me to have a war. To restore him to his former glory?
Cardin asks. Pretty much, I say.
Now that's ambition,
Cardin says.
There might be only a floodplain and several pine trees still on fire remaining, but the four folk huddling together in a damp cave would have heard the name Grimson. One must admire the focus. I don't suppose you told him that declaring war was your call, not mine.
If he is the true High King of Elfheim, whom we are to follow to the end of days, then we've been a mite disrespectful, running the kingdom for him. But if he's play-acting, then he's a spy for sure, and better than most of us. Of course not, I say. For a moment, there is silence between us. He takes a step toward me.
The other night.
I cut him off. I did it for the same reason that you did, to get it out of my system.
And is it?
He asks.
Out of your system?
I look him in the face and lie. Yes. If he touches me, if he even takes another step toward me, my deceit will be exposed. I don't think I can keep the longing off my face. Instead, to my relief, he gives a thin-lipped nod and departs. From the next room, I hear the Roach call out to Cardin, to offer to teach him the trick of levitating a playing card. I hear Cardin laugh. It occurs to me that maybe desire isn't something overindulging helps. Maybe it is not unlike Mithridatism. Maybe I took a killing dose when I should have been poisoning myself slowly, one kiss at a time. I am unsurprised to find Matic in his strategy room in the palace, but he is surprised by me, unused to my sly footing. Father, I say.
I used to think I wanted you to call me that,
he says.
But it turns out that when you do, good things seldom come after.
Not at all, I say. I came to tell you that you were right. I hate the idea of Oaks being in danger. But if we can engineer when the Underseas strike comes, that's safer for Oak.
You've been planning out the guarding of him while he's here.
He grins, showing his sharp teeth.
Hard to cover every eventuality.
Impossible, I sigh, walking deeper into the room. So I'm on board. Let me help misdirect the Undersea. I have resources. He's been a general a long time. He planned Dane's murder and got away with it. He's better at this than I am.
What if you only want to thwart me?
He asks.
You can hardly expect me to take it on faith that now you are in earnest.
Although Matic has every reason to distrust me, it stings. I wonder what it would have been like if he had shared his plans for putting Oak on the throne before I was witness to the coronation bloodbath. Had he trusted me to be a part of his scheme, I wonder if I would have waved away my doubts. I don't like to think of that being possible, but I fear it might be. I wouldn't put my brother at risk, I say, half in response to him, half in response to my own fears.
Oh?
He asks.
Not even to save him from my clutches?
I guess I deserve that. You said you wanted me to come back to your side. Here's your chance to show me what it would be like to work with you. Persuade me. While I control the throne, we can't ever truly be on the same side. But maybe we could work together. Maybe he can channel his ambition into beating the Undersea and forget about the throne, at least until Oak comes of age. By then, at least, things will be different. He indicates the table with a map of the islands and his carved figurines.
Orla has a week to strike, unless she means to set a trap back in the mortal world in Oak's absence. You have guards on Vivienne's apartment, ones you've engaged outside the military, and who do not look like knights. Clever, but nothing and no one is infallible. I think the place most advantageous for us to tempt them into striking.
The Undersea is going to make its move during Terran's wedding.
What?
He gives me a narrowed-eyed evaluation.
How do you know that?
Nikasia, I say. And I think I can narrow things more if we work fast. I have a way to get information to Baelkin. Information that he will believe. Maddox's eyebrows rise. I nod. A prisoner. I've already sent information through her successfully. He turns away from me to pour himself a finger of some dark liquor and flop back into a leather chair.
These are the resources you mentioned?
I do not come to you empty-handed, I say. Aren't you at least a little pleased you decided to trust me?
I could claim that it was you who finally decided to trust me. Now it remains to be seen how well we will work together. There are many more projects on which we could collaborate.
Like taking the throne. One misadventure at a time, I caution him.
Does he know?
Matic asks, grinning in a slightly terrifying yet paternal fashion.
Does our High King have any idea how good you are at running his kingdom for him?
Keep hoping he doesn't, I say, trying for a breezy confidence that I don't feel when it comes to anything to do with Cardin or our arrangement. Matic laughs.
Oh, I shall, daughter. Much as I hope you will realize how much better it would be if you were running it for your own family.
Cardin's audience with Baelkin takes place the next day. My spies tell me Cardin spent the night alone. No riotous parties, no drunken revels, no contests for liars. I do not know how to interpret that. Baelkin is led into the throne room in chains, but he walks with his head up, in clothing far too fine for the tower. He flaunts his ability to obtain luxuries, flaunts his arrogance, as though Cardin is to be awed by this, instead of annoyed. For his part, Cardin looks especially formidable.
He wears a coat of mossy velvet, embroidered all over in bright gold. The earring given to him by Grimson dangles from his lobe, catching the light as he turns his head. No revelers are here today, but the room is not empty. Randolin and Nior stand together near the dais to one side, near three guards. I am on the other, standing near a patch of shadows. Servants linger nearby, ready to pour wine or play harps, as suits the High King's pleasure. I arranged with Volsiber for Lady Asha to get a note, just as Baelkin was being brought up the stairs and out of the tower for this audience. The note read, "I have thought over your requests and want to negotiate. There's a way to get you off the island, immediately after my sister's wedding. For his safety, my little brother is being brought back by boat because flying made him ill. You can go too, without the High King being the wiser, as the journey is, of necessity, secret. If you agree that this will suffice, send me word back, and we will meet again to discuss my past and your future. Jay." There is some chance that she will say nothing to Baelkin when he returns to his cell. But since she has passed on information to him already, and since he doubtlessly saw her get the note, I believe he will not stand for her hearing there was nothing to it, especially as, being a fairy, she must engage in evasions rather than outright lies.
"Little brother,"
Baelkin says, without waiting to be acknowledged. He wears the chained cuffs on his wrists as though they are bracelets, as though they add to his status, instead of marking him as a prisoner.
"You requested an audience with the crown,"
Cardin says.
"No, brother. It was you I wanted to speak with, not the ornament on your head."
Baelkin's sly disrespect makes me wonder why he wanted this audience in the first place. I think of Matic, and how around him, I am perpetually a child. It's no small thing to pass judgment on the person who raised you, no matter what else they have done. This confrontation is less about this moment, and more about the vast sweep of their past, the warp and weft of old resentments and alliances between them.
"What is it you want?"
Cardin asks. His voice remains mild, but empty of the bored authority he usually wields.
"What does any prisoner want?"
Baelkin says.
"Let me out of the tower. If you mean to succeed, you need my help."
"If you've been trying to see me only to say that, your efforts have been to no purpose. No, I will not release you. No, I do not need you."
Cardin sounds certain. Baelkin smiles.
"You've locked me away for fear of me. After all, you hated Eldred more than I did. You despise Dane. How can you punish me for deaths you do not regret?"
Cardin looks at Baelkin in disbelief, half rising from the throne. His fists are balled. His face is that of a person who has forgotten where he is.
"What of Elowyn? What of Kalia and Rhaya? If all I cared for were my own feelings, their deaths would be enough reason for me to revenge myself on you. They were our sisters, and they would have been better rulers than either you or I."
I thought Baelkin would back down at that, but he doesn't. Instead, an insidious little smile grows on his mouth.
"Did they intercede for you? Did any one of your dear sisters take you in? How can you think they cared for you when they wouldn't go against father for your sake?"
For a moment, I think Cardin is going to strike him. My hand goes to the hilt of my own sword. I will get in front of him. I will fight Baelkin. It would be my pleasure to fight Baelkin. Instead, Cardin slumps back down onto the throne. The fury leaves his face, and he speaks as though Baelkin's last words went unheard.
"But you are locked away, neither because I fear you, nor for revenge. I did not indulge myself with your punishment. You are in the tower because it is just."
"You can't do this alone,"
Bilkin says, looking around the room.
You've never cared for work. Never cared to flatter diplomats or follow duty instead of pleasure. Give me the difficult tasks, instead of giving them to some mortal girl to whom you feel indebted and who will only fail you.
The eyes of Nior and Randolin and a few of the guards go to me, but Cardin watches his brother. After a long moment, he speaks.
You would be my regent, though I am of age. You come before me, not as a penitent, but as before a stray dog you would call to heel.
Finally, Bilkin looks discomfited.
Although I have sometimes been harsh with you, it was because I sought to make you better. Do you think that you can be indolent and self-indulgent and yet succeed here as a ruler? Without me, you would be nothing. Without me, you will be nothing.
The idea that Bailkin can say those words without believing them a lie is shocking. Cardin, for his part, wears a small smile, and when he speaks, his voice is light.
You threaten me. You praise yourself. You give away your desires. Even were I considering your offer, after that little speech, I would be sure you were no diplomat.
Bilkin takes a furious step toward the throne, and guards close the space between them. I can see Bilkin's physical urge to punish Cardin.
You are playing at being king,
Bilkin says.
And if you do not know it, then you are the only one. Send me back to prison. Lose my help. And lose the kingdom.
That, Cardin says. The second option. The one that doesn't involve you. That's the one I choose.
He turns to Volsibur.
This audience is over.
As Volsibur and the other guards move to escort Bilkin back to the Tower of Forgetting, his gaze goes to me, and in his eyes, I see a well of hate so deep that I fear that if we're not careful, all of Elfheim may drown in it. Two nights before my sister's wedding, I stand in front of the long mirror in my rooms and slowly draw Nightfell. I move through the stances, the ones Matic taught me, the ones I learned in the Court of Shadows. Then I raise my blade, presenting it to my opponent. I salute her in the mirror. Back and forth, I dance across the floor, fighting her. I strike and parry, parry and strike. I feign. I duck. I watch sweat bead on her forehead. I battle on until perspiration stains her shirt, until she's shaking with exhaustion. It's still not enough. I can never beat her.
Chapter 20. The trap for Orla is set. I spend the day with Matic going over the particulars. We created three specific times and places where the undersea could strike with some confidence. The boat itself, carrying a decoy, is obvious. It requires a hob to pretend to be Oak, huddling in a cloak, and the boat itself to be enchanted to fly. Before that, there is a moment during Terran's reception when Oak is to wander off on his own into the maze. A section of the greenery will be replaced with tree folk, who will remain unseen until they need to strike. And even before that, upon arrival at Locke's estate for the wedding, Oak will seem to step out of the carriage onto an open patch of land visible from the ocean. We will employ the decoy there as well. I will wait with the real Oak in the carriage while the rest of the family goes out and, hopefully, the sea strikes. Then the carriage will pull around and we will climb straight through a window. In this case, the trees near the shore will be full of sprites, ready to spot the denizens of the undersea, and a net has been buried under the sand to trap them. Three chances to catch the undersea in an attempt to harm Oak. Three chances to make them regret trying. We do not neglect protecting Cardin either. His personal guard is on high alert.
He has his own coterie of archers who will follow his every move. And, of course, our spies. Taryn wants to spend her last night before the wedding with her sisters, so I pack up a dress and Taryn's earrings in a rucksack and tie it to the back of the same horse I once took to Innsweil. I strap Nightfell across one saddlebag. Then I ride to Maddox's estate. The night is beautiful. A breeze runs through the trees, fragrant with the scent of pine needles and everapple. Distantly, I hear hoofbeats. Foxes make their odd screaming calls to one another. The trill of flute music comes from somewhere far off, along with the sound of mermaids singing their high-pitched, wordless songs out on the rocks. Then, abruptly, the hoofbeats are no longer distant. Through the woods come riders, 7 of them, mounted on the backs of pearl-eyed, emaciated horses. Their faces are covered, their armor splashed with white paint. I can hear their laughter as they split apart to come at me from different angles. For a moment, I think there must be some mistake. One of them draws an axe, which shines under the light of the first quarter moon, putting a chill into my blood. No, there is no mistake. They have come to kill me. My experience fighting on horseback is limited. I thought I would be a knight in Elfheim, defending some royal's body and honor, not riding into battles like Matic. Now, as they close in on me, I think about who was aware of that particular vulnerability. Certainly Matic knew. Perhaps this is his method of repaying me for my betrayal. Perhaps trusting me was a ruse. After all, he knew I was headed to his stronghold tonight, and we spent the afternoon planning traps just like this. Regretfully, I think of the roach's warning. Next time, take a member of the royal guard. Take one of us. Take a cloud of sprites or a drunken spriggan. Just take someone. But it's just me, alone. I urge my horse to greater speed. If I can make it through the woods and get close enough to the house, then I'll be safe. There are guards there, and whether or not Matic put the riders up to this, he would never let a guest, not to mention his ward, be slain on his own lands. That wouldn't be playing by the rules of courtesy. All I have to do is make it. The hoofbeats pound behind me as we streak through the woods. I look back, wind in my face, hair blowing into my mouth. They're riding far apart, trying to get enough ahead of me to herd me away from Maddox, toward the coast, where there's nowhere to hide. Closer and closer they come. I can hear them calling to one another, but the words are lost in the wind. My horse is fast, but theirs flow like water through the night. As I look back, I see one of them has drawn a bow with black fletched arrows. I wheel my mount to one side, only to find another rider there cutting off my escape. They are armored, with weapons in hand. I have only a few knives on me, and Nightfell back with my saddlebags, along with a small crossbow and the pack itself. I walked through these woods hundreds of times in my childhood. I never thought I would need to be armored for battle here. An arrow whizzes past me as another rider closes, brandishing a blade. There is no way I will outrun them. I stand up in the stirrups, a trick I am not sure is going to work, and then grab hold of the next sturdy branch I pass. One of the white-eyed steeds bares its teeth and bites down on the flank of my own mount. My poor animal whinnies and bucks. In the moonlight, I think I make out amber eyes as a rider's long sword swings through the air. I vault up, hauling myself onto the branch. For a moment, I just hold onto it, breathing hard, as the riders pass beneath me.